Welcome to History 101, World History since 1500. Second lecture, State of the World in 1492. In the previous lecture, I said that the world in 1492 was more diverse, whether in forms of political organization or of religion, or of economic organization, than it has ever been since. If you are to visualize the world around 1492, one way of doing so would be to see it as five big and dense complexes of humanity: Western Europe, China, India, Mesoamerica, and the Andes, and a couple of smaller clusters, some of which were course a major civilizations too, such as the Middle East, and a couple of other major dense groups of humanity. These dense clusters were separated by empty wastes, by mountains, by deserts, by steppes, by seas, and in Europe, above all, by forests. Forests that sheltered equally ferocious animals as ferocious humans. This also meant an entirely different outlook on nature. To modern Western urbanites, much less so for African ones, and probably barring people who live in Alaska or in the Australian outback, nature is something you enjoy. In the early modern period, nature was something you avoided at all costs. The sense of dread and fear which European forest instilled is perhaps best conveyed in the fairy tales of Grimm. Partly, these fairy tales are a reflection of life as it was in the Holy Roman Empire in the 18th century, and partly they reflect much older European lore and European religion, that indeed goes back to the Ice Age. And in particular, the Hansel and Gretel story is exemplary. In that story, as you'll recall, about the worst thing which may happen to you is that you get lost in a forest, where you'll either be eaten by a wild wolf, or you'll be caught by an evil witch. And Europe was still a small, domesticated place, a place on a very human scale. Try imagine the sheer dread the Spanish conquistadors experienced as they first faced the mighty Cordilleras of the Andes, or the awesome Altiplano. The wilderness there was on a scale that utterly dwarfed anything Europeans were familiar with, and it was on a scale for which no human author had ever prepared them. These dense complexes of humanity included a couple of well-known areas that are all immediately recognizable as the course of major civilizations, and that would also immediately come to mind as such: Western Europe, China, Japan and Korea, India, the river valleys of the Middle East, the Nile and the Euphrates, Western Anatolia, and in the Americas, there were the Andes, the Yucatan Peninsula, and Mesoamerica, the latter two, of course, linked. Then there were the river valleys of Southeast Asia, the Irrawaddy, and the Mekong. Beyond those valleys lay densely forested mountains, which were populated by ethnically quite diverse and different slash and burn cultivators who were utterly different from the inhabitants of the river valleys. And there was also in Southeast Asia that other major population center, the island of Java, that, because of its heavy rainfall and volcanic soil, can support up to 3 rice harvests a year. The rest of the Indonesian archipelago, on the other hand, consisted of virtually empty jungle, pockets of population, enclosed within dense forests where the tigers roamed, and those areas even had limited contact with one another. There were a couple of smaller areas too, areas which do not immediately spring to mind, but which also supported comparatively large agrarian populations, although they were simply too small to form independent civilizations on a par with those of China or India. Thus, for example, the Zarafshan, Samarkand and Tashkent area of Central Asia, that was watered by the Pamir Mountains, or again, the highlands of Yemen. Both of them are relatively small pockets of dense population, enclosed in deserts and steppes, and both are very distant and distinct from all the rest. Yemen, of course, is the core of the ancient Sabaean kingdom that can at least be traced back to the 6th century before Common Era, and Zarafshan was the core of ancient Khwarizm, an ancient area of civilization since at least the beginning of Trans-Eurasian trade in copper in the 15th century before Common Era. These two areas, of course, have a lot in common with their surroundings. Yemen, for example, speaks Arabic. Yet Yemenitic Arabic is so distinct from all other dialects of Arabic that it's almost a language by itself. And in Europe, it would meanwhile have officially been classed as a language by itself. It is much more different from Arabic than, say, Frisian is from Dutch, or Catalan is from Spanish. Turning to Africa, I would include the coastal area of Morocco, and the region which has probably always spotted the largest concentrated population in sub-Saharan Africa, the highlands of Ethiopia. And those highlands are in many ways much more closely linked to neighboring Yemen than they are to the rest of Africa. They are, in my view, called African only by convenient conventions of area studies. Then there is the core land of West Africa, the Niger Valley, and the dense cluster of humanity in western Nigeria, the city-states of the Yoruba. And finally, there is one area which already spotted a dense population in the 15th century, but about which we know pitifully little, since, for obvious reasons, not a lot of historical research, let alone archaeological research, has been done there in the past 3 decades. The Great Lakes, present-day Rwanda, Burundi. Finally, there were 2 more areas which also spotted very large agrarian populations, but that virtually evolved on their own planet, as they had few or no contacts with all the rest of humanity. There was 1 area in the Caribbean which had a very dense population, the only area in the entire Caribbean where virtually every inch of ground was settled and cultivated, namely Hispaniola, Haiti. And there is 1 more area of which we have only recently come to realize it has been a major agrarian center since at least 8000 before Common Era, namely New Guinea. The agriculture there was partly built on the cultivation of a food crop most listeners are probably not familiar with at all, but also on a plant that is basically New Guinea's gift to all the world's diets, the banana, a plant which diffused from New Guinea around 2000 before Common Era. New Guinea is a fascinating, I might plead, a decisive case for the importance of doing linked world history by itself. Basically, the Neolithic Revolution occurred in New Guinea nearly as early as in the Fertile Crescent, and it occurred earlier than in the Americas, Yet New Guinea then remained stuck on a Neolithic level. It evolved no cities, no class systems, no kingdoms, no full-time priests or officials, no written language, and technologically, it remained stuck in the Stone Age, as it had, I feel, virtually no contact with the outside world. While the terrain of New Guinea, rugged, jungle-covered mountains, precluded any rise of the kind of centralized kingdoms as occurred in the Fertile Crescent. Now, if you look at a map of world population densities, if you're talking about animals, you tend to talk about the natural habitat of this or that species, and if you simply look at the map of population densities in the world, it's still the case that Homo sapiens is an animal whose natural habitat are river valleys, and in particular river valleys in two places, the South Asia region and China. Together, these two account for half the human population, and they've likely already done so since at least the 2nd century Common Era. Historians linked to the journal Annales Économie, Société et Civilisation, most of them were clearly early modern historians, as this is much clearer to discern in early modern history and in modern history, which is in a way simply too close to us to be able to discern any long-run pattern that stretches over several centuries, used to talk about the longue durée, that is, the very long run in human history. Pattern that remained, and remained immutable, for centuries, even for millennia. And though the word has fallen in disuse recently, as it was linked to an academic fad of the 60s, structuralism, a fad that has long been forgotten, or perhaps deservedly been consigned to oblivion, I would imagine the very long run of world history as follows. And note, listeners, that this longue durée stretches from about the 2nd century Common Era to somewhere in the 1980s, an issue I will have a lot more to say about in a later lecture. The average human being throughout these 2000 years was a man, because India and China have long had skewed sex ratios, as they still have, 100 males to 80 females. In India, it recently dropped to only 70. That average human being was a peasant. He lived in a very small village, with very little notion of anything beyond walking distance of that village. He spoke a dialect. A dialect that was commonly completely incomprehensible to any outsider. He worshipped a local village deity, a village deity which vaguely fitted within some global Hindu or Taoist pantheon, but was otherwise completely unknown outside of the region. The average human being mistrusted any outsider from outside the village. For if he had any contact with the outside world at all, it was commonly either in the form of marauding armies or haughty tax collectors. The average human being tilled the soil with the very same implements he had been using for thousands of years. He distrusted any innovation. The average human being had to do heavy manual labor on a diet which was commonly just enough to survive on, and he had to face famine every 20 years, whence both Indian and Chinese peasant values tend to stress extreme frugality. The average Chinese peasant could afford a new pair of shoes every 2 years. And in the 70s, Indian peasants were still dressed in ragged clothes they had been wearing for years, and were always full of holes. Kingdoms might come and go, but this peasant would still till the very same land he had been on for thousands of years. In both cases, this process of China and India becoming the very hubs of world population, to very much generalize, were linked to a process that is called southernization. Populations, which originally clustered in the cold and subtropical north of China and India, gradually expanded to the south, in the course of which they shifted from cultivated grain, in both cases, to rice, while they absorbed, or sometimes they replaced, original populations, as is for example the case in India with speakers of Munda languages, a group of languages that are not linguistic cognates of the other two main Indian language groups, Indo-Aryan and Dravidian. It has been speculated they are very distantly related to Australian Aboriginal languages. Nowadays, these languages are only spoken in a very small belt of forest and jungle in central India, present-day state Jharkhand. There are, however, good grounds for believing they were once the main language group in all of India. The Munda languages, then, are languages of the original inhabitants of the plains, which were gradually pushed by Indo-Aryan and Dravidian migrations into the hills and into the forest, as the plains of river valleys gradually filled up with Hindu-Aryan or Dravidian-speaking peasants, and with hierarchical peasant societies. Similarly, the Sino-Tibetan-speaking Chinese minorities were gradually submerged by Chinese-speaking cultivators in a very long process that started around the 3rd century Common Era and was more or less accomplished by the 8th, and in which the center of Chinese civilization gradually shifted from Lhasa in the north to the south, and in which, much as the Munda speakers, the Tibetan language group was gradually pushed into remote mountain areas. Now, by comparison, in Europe, you might actually speak of northernization from the 7th, 8th century Common Era onward, as the densest center of population in Europe had obviously long been the south. If you trace the history of a village in central Italy, you can commonly go back to the Etruscans, 10th century before Common Era. In northern Europe, the history of a village commonly reaches back to the 8th, 9th century Common Era. From the 8th century onward, the center of European population gradually shifted towards the north, as the heavy horse-drawn plow allowed plowing the heavy rain-sodden soils of northern Europe. It was an epic process, though we admittedly know much more about it than we do about the equally epic southernization. Historians commonly call the high medieval expansion of Europe, and that stretched from roughly the 9th to the 13th century, as that process by the 13th century began to run out of steam, and it then gave way to a very long agrarian depression that basically stretched up to the mid-18th century. During those 500 years, the amount of cultivated land in Western Europe remained more or less the same of what it had been in the 13th. All this has had major consequences for Europe's past, for Europe's present, and the need for Europe's future. If you look at an image of Europe at night, the center of the continent is a thick belt of light that runs from northern Italy to the Low Countries, broadly from Venice to Amsterdam, and that perhaps crosses the channel into southern England. That belt of light has roughly the city of Frankfurt in Germany as its focal point. And that's one reason why Frankfurt is nowadays the main center of finance in Europe. For though the geographic center of Europe is Prague, and if you count European Russia in, maybe Bucharest, its center of commerce and population has long been the central belt, the very same axis as that of the Carolingian Empire in the 8th century, the period when this axis first emerged. And an area that was in the Treaty of Verdun in 843 recognized as a separate kingdom. It was called Lotharingia, hence modern Lorraine. Yet that central area has always been divided among several kingdoms ever since. Though there was admittedly one attempt, that of the Duchy of Burgundy in the 15th century, to unite it as a single kingdom. Partly, this area has always been divided because the rulers of France, and to a lesser extent of Germany, would under no circumstance allow this area to be united. And partly too, this area has never been united because this rich area of major cities and major hubs of trade could fight off attempts of monarchs to subdue them in a way that much smaller French or Spanish cities could not. So, this is the axis of trade and of urbanization in Europe. That links the two most heavily urbanized areas in Europe, the Low Countries and Italy. As can also be seen from a map of Europe at night, the rest of Europe is quite dark, except the bright lights of capitals within a dark rural sea. Most striking is the case of Paris, but also striking are the bright lights of Madrid on the otherwise dark Iberian Peninsula, and if you look at the map closely, you'll see that Europe gets ever darker the more you move to the east, and the more you move to the south as well. Now, beyond these dense clusters, humans tended to occur much more sparsely. And where they did, they tended typically to cluster on river valleys. Thus in Africa, where the dense populations tended up to the 13th century to cluster around the Niger, and forest areas to the south were much less densely populated. Similarly so, as I said already, in Southeast Asia, where kingdoms tended to cluster on river valleys, and jungles and mountains tended to be inhabited by minorities, practicing what is called Sweden cultivation. That is, that patches of jungle are burned down, cultivated for a couple of years, and then abandoned again. There is one very peculiar and very strange exception to the rule, that jungle tended to push human beings away, namely the New World, where an environment which commonly supports a very low population, the jungle, supported an extremely dense population in only one place, Yucatan. Now, what we call civilization, that is big cities living off the products of an agrarian hinterland, monumental architecture, commonly but not always, advanced systems for the division of labor, networks of chains involving non-essential luxury products, and the class of specialists who devote themselves either to the full-term pursuit of religion, of culture, or of war, has a carriage capacity. And it tends maybe to expand in a cyclical pattern, after which it tends to break down again. In fact, a group of Russian mathematicians has recently developed an interesting mathematical model that when populations of civilizations reach the ceiling of this carriage capacity, their growth rate declines towards zero value. The system then experiences significant stress, with declines in living standards, increasing the severity of famines, those in turn cause of rebellions, etc. Most complex grain systems, according to this model, have considerable reserves for stability. However, within 150 years, these reserves tend to become exhausted, and the system then experiences a long demographic collapse, when increasingly severe famines, epidemics, internal warfare, and other disasters lead to considerable decline of population. As a result of such a collapse, free resources then become available. Per capita production increases, population growth resumes, and a new social demographic cycle starts. It is a model that probably works best for ancient America, for which it has been originally developed, but it has some applicability to Eurasia as well. Now, there are, to be sure, a few civilizations that have developed in very thinly populated areas. Tibet is one case, Russia is another. But in general, civilizations need large, productive agrarian populations. For these elites, who produce warfare, prayer, lofty thoughts, all live for what in Marxist theory is called surplus value. That is, that share of the production of the land that is not directly consumed by peasant families, and that does not need to be reserved for the sowing for next year. And these elites really add very little to production themselves, unless praying for rain can be rated as productive work. Beyond these dense clusters of humanity, humans either lived in what anthropologists call chiefdoms, that is, egalitarian villages that were cultivating crops for direct use and conducted some barters with their neighbors under a big man, who was mostly only slightly wealthier than the rest, but was recognized as spokesman or as chief priest for the rest of the community, or in nomadic societies that tended animals as the main source of food, or in hunter-gatherer bands. This means basically that most of the world was still inhabited by non-state, in technical terms, by acephalous groups of rather egalitarian villagers, or by hunter-gatherer groups, or by pastoral nomads. Now we, people nowadays, tend to think of such societies as impoverished, wandering, nude bands that lived in deep poverty. But the thing is, this is an elite judgment. Compared to the fate of the average European peasant or the average European mariner, the life of the hunter-gatherers or the nomads wasn't that bad. Nay, it might be altogether enviable. Thus, for example, when the Native Americans in North America first got in contact with Europeans, most of whom were, of course, common mariners, the first thing that struck them was their foul smell. And they were right in that, as Europeans in the 17th century was rarely or never, so they probably smelled really, really filthy. And the second thing which struck them was how small in size they were. All Europeans were to them midgets. And that is, of course, a thousand years of living on a monotonous diet of gruel, with meat perhaps once a month, for that was what the European peasants and working classes ate, will do to somebody. By every objective standard, the life of a Huron or of a Mohican in the 17th century was far preferable to that of a peasant in Scotland or Lancashire. And the peasants actually thought so too. And for this reason, such kind of egalitarian societies have been, over thousands of years, a threat to the elites of the civilizations, as their subject peasant populations would probably have far preferred to live amongst the barbarians, or indeed amongst the steppe nomads, who at least enjoyed far greater liberty than any Chinese peasant did. The famous argument on this line, being one of the great historical works of the 20th century, sadly mostly forgotten again, namely Owen Latimore's Inner Asian Frontiers of China. Latimore there argues that the Great Wall of China was not built to keep nomads out, as to keep Chinese peasants in. Peasants who might otherwise well choose to become nomads, as the life of nomads was in many ways far preferable to that of a Chinese peasant. Therefore, the intellectuals of the civilizations had constantly to convince the peasants that staying under their yoke was still far preferable to leading the life of a barbarian. Over thousands of years, the main cleft was not between civilizations or between civilized societies, as their elites perceived them, which, if there were surely major differences, had still in common the elements of an urban elite, as rather between civilizations and the barbarians, that is, societies who did not have elite specialists, and commonly no cities, and no advanced systems of division of labor either. Such a prime distinction between us and the other has persisted in the new and old world for thousands of years, and in some places, such as northern Kenya or the southern Sudan, despite the virtual eradication of barbarian societies in the last 500 years, but particularly in the last 200 years, and I shall deal with that later, it still exists. Thus in the case of the Inuit in Canada, of the Khoisan in South Africa, of the Aboriginals in Australia, or even to some extent the Laps and the Komi of the Kola Peninsula in Europe. All these are hunter-gatherer band societies, and they are still very imperfectly integrated in their surrounding modernity. And they're struggling with it. For even now, to them, though it may bring some material benefits, civilization has major disadvantages. Disadvantages that often outweigh any material benefit. What is the use of a TV if you're locked in a house within four walls? Nay, such disadvantages may even outweigh material benefits and better healthcare. Thus, for example, the sense of deference that is inculcated in civilized people since childhood is an unacceptable curtailment of liberty in non-hierarchical societies. In such societies, as hunter-gatherer bands, everybody is seen as equal. The idea that you would see somebody as your better or your inferior is bred into civilized people. It isn't bred into barbarians. And again, the idea with which we are raised, that the more goods you own, the better you are, and such goods, furthermore, you then all bizarrely have to keep to yourself, and you surely never share them with anyone, that, worst of all, you may even legally deny your children your goods. From Western law, you may draw a clause in your will that you will deny your inheritance to your very children. All that would strike the Chinook or the Kwakiutl living on the Canadian Pacific coast as utterly bizarre. There, of course, you become a social better the more goods you give away to others, so that the aim of acquiring things is merely to give them away. Again, however hard this is to imagine for most of us, who used to spend their whole life imprisoned within four walls, and who are never allowed to wander freely, as all land is always fenced off by barbed wire and no trespass allowed signs. This would be a true inferno for traditional hunter-gatherer groups. For them, liberty is freedom to wander where you want, and to spend the night in the open air. A house in one place, to hunter-gatherers, is a prison. Australian Aboriginal does, for example, prefer, if they have a house at all, to live in a camping van, a house that can at least move. States have therefore always found it extremely difficult to accommodate nomadic people, as they typically tend to cramp them into a confined space and take any opportunity to wander from them. And that is the very definition of serfdom for nomadic people. Now, on this point, I have to make a digression, but it is an important one. One thing which never ceases to amaze me is the confidence with which theoretic economic historians, of whom there are frankly far too many nowadays, confidently build huge generalizations on supposed hard figures for any period before 1800. To bluntly put it, they commonly simply invent figures if they have no figures available. I can recall one of such supposed theoretic economic historians confidently pontificating about the share of the Spanish state debt relative to Spain's gross national product in 1600. Yet we have no data about the Spanish gross national product before 1600 whatsoever. And what I find quite worrying is that complete Mickey Mouse figures, such as the gross national product of China or India or Spain in 1600, and of all those places, for all those places, we have no data whatsoever, that such data are increasingly being served to us as hard statistical evidence on which you can then confidently build fast generalizations. One egregious example of this is the book of University of Davis economist Professor George Clark, A Farewell to Arms, where Clark uses all kinds of very impressive looking graphs, all built on complete Mickey Mouse figures, to argue that in the entire pre-industrial world, no less than that, any growth of output was impossible, as such a growth of output would always be eaten up by a growth of population. The point is that this goes entirely against what I've just been saying about medieval Europe, where there was both a considerable expansion of acreage and of agrarian output from the 9th to the 13th century. What we know about China or India also completely contradicts this point, but I'm tempted to say, for Clark, if actual data contradict his graphs, so much the worse for the data. And, as everybody now uses it for writing papers, I would urge particular caution when using Wikipedia. Wikipedia is full of Mickey Mouse figures, referenced or merely paraded as hard evidence. Now, in reality, the only hard figures we have before 1700 are the figures on state revenue. That was probably the only thing states were then reasonably sure about. All the rest was guesswork. And most sources before the 18th century have, in addition, a tendency to wildly exaggerate figures. That is a very obvious human temptation. Let me give a contemporary example to illustrate this further. Back in the 1970s, when people in the Netherlands were still protesting and manifesting a lot, if there had been a manifestation, in the evening news, the news would always give two figures of how many people had attended some meeting. One was by the organizers, and they would say something like 30,000 people attended our meeting, and one was by the police, and they would say perhaps 3,000. Of course, the interest of the police is to deflate figures, that the organizer was to inflate figures. A safe guess would perhaps be 10,000. Practically the same applies to any figure given before 1700. It is always wise to halve any figure. For states before 1700, basically did not see it as their task to compile figures. And state did not have a bureau of statistics, as all states are supposed to have nowadays. Although, almost all figures on Africa are guesswork, even nowadays. The first statistical office of any state was established in Sweden in the 30s of the 18th century. Before that, compiling statistics was, if it was ever done at all, mostly a responsibility of the municipalities, or of the church, or of lords of the manor. Thus, in Europe, compiling statistics on population, when people were born, when they had children, when they died, was a responsibility of the local church, and it was written down in registers of the local church. The local church, that is, because bishops did not keep any central statistics. That means that if you want to have a realistic idea of the population of a given area, you'll have to wade through thousands of thick church registers. Again, states did not keep statistics on even something as basic as foreign trade, as carrying taxes on that was mostly a responsibility of the municipality. Thus, for example, as such a very major port as Amsterdam, we do not have lists on how many ships arrived, with how much cargo, or how much value. What we have instead are merely a few summary statements of how much taxes all that traffic yielded. Fundamentally, for most of continental Europe, all figures before the age of the French Revolution, when states began for the first time to gather systematic data, are guesswork. What this also means is that almost all statistics we have about Europe before roughly 1700 are crude estimates, and there may be hundreds of thousands of, whether these figures relate to foreign trade or to population. Nor are figures on other places any more reliable. Many economic historians now think you can base fast generalizations on such kinds of shaky figures, but I should at least warn my listeners, all these figures, however confidently asserted, are all quicksand. So with this word of caution in mind, let me now enter into some very crude estimates of the world's population around 1492, that is immediately before the epidemics that virtually emptied the New World. First figures on Asia, and these estimates are as follows. China around 1500, about 135 million inhabitants, Korea 5 million, and Japan 13 to 15 million. And since both Japan and China kept censuses for tax purposes, these figures are quite certain. All the other figures I will now quote are rough estimates, mostly because the sources haven't survived. Java's population around 1500 can be estimated at roughly 3 to 4 million. That of Vietnam, 5 million. Burma, 3 million. India is extremely contentious. Estimates ranged up to about 130 million. But personally, I think the figure should be downward. I would come to about 80 million. The population of the Ottoman Empire, as the Ottoman Empire did assess people by household, is quite certain. Ottoman Anatolia had 13 million inhabitants. Syria had 6 million, Egypt had 5 million, and Iraq disastrously declined since the High Middle Ages, had less than 1 million. The population of Iran is commonly estimated at 8 million. But I have to admit, I think these low Iranian figures are suspicious. It is more likely it was higher, as this figure is based on calculating backwards from the 19th century. We have very little information about the Central Asian steppes. Sarafshan may have had about 1.5 million people. For Siberia, a very rough estimate would be about 2 million people. They were obviously spread over a very vast space, and in all likeness, they decreased sharply from the 14th century onward. For if there was one area which was likely to be hit by the Little Ice Age, that I spoke about in the previous lecture, it would likely have been Siberia. Second, I turn to the figures for Europe. Figures that I should already say in advance are quite certain. France had 13 million inhabitants. England had 4 million. Sweden had less than 1 million. Germany as a whole, however fake that term is, had 15 to 16 million. Spain had 8 million. The Netherlands a bit more than 1 million. And Portugal about 900,000. Ireland had likely about 600,000. The Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, very complicated territorial unit I will speak about in a later lecture, had 11 million and Russia had 8 million. On this point, I should underline that modern state designations and modern state boundaries, modern state names indeed, make absolutely no sense in this period. The typical territorial unit of Europe had, if it was small, the size of the three remnants of the typical 15th century state remaining, namely the states of Liechtenstein, of Andorra, and of San Marino. A bigger state in the 15th century had the size of Luxembourg. Germany was an array of bigger and smaller kingdoms, of duchies, of free cities, and independent bishops. So was Italy. France was, after the final defeat of the English attempt to found a separate kingdom in Gascony, 1453, and the death of Charles the Bold of Burgundy at Nancy in 1477, again a single kingdom, but it still consisted of an array of duchies and of comtes, all of which had to do with one another, and indeed wanted to have as little to do with one another as possible. Now, I should add that all these figures are, after nearly 70 years of ceaseless toil of historians to extract any available shred of evidence from the church registers, pretty reliable. The first thing to note here is the demographic preponderance of France in Western Europe, and this made it the most powerful state in Europe anyway. The most powerful state of Europe, it was to remain until 1871, provided that Germany was not united, and that was the main threat of French policy for over 400 years. Note however also that, since, as said, the economic axis of Europe was not located in France, it might well be the politically most powerful state, but the center of economic activity was always beyond France's border, and it was located, as before, in Lotharingia. That had been the situation since the 12th century, since the decline of champagne markets in the 12th century, and the French policy since the 13th century was therefore to obtain a foothold in one of the two true economic centers of Europe, whether in northern Italy or the Low Countries. Note furthermore they have been a miracle preponderance of France over England. And that was to remain the situation until the late 18th century. To which I may add, that in my view, and contrary to what Whig historians always argue, England in 1492 was not a particularly prosperous country either. And this, obviously, makes the stubborn attempts of the English to gain a foothold in France understandable, as to the English monarchs of the 15th century, England was a peripheral appendage to France. France was both wealthier and more populous than England. Finally note, the surprisingly low figure for Russia, or rather the Duchy of Muscovy. Russia reached an all-time low of population in the 14th and 15th century. This was partly caused by the Little Ice Age, and particularly because the southern Russia region, or modern Ukraine, that had been the center of Rus in the 13th century, was getting drier, and hence the center of Russia shifted to the before thinly occupied forest zone in the north. Yet this very low figure may also have been caused by the rampant slave trade from Russia, and from the Ukraine in particular, from roughly the 1300 to 1500. First by the Mongols, and then by their successor state, the Golden Horde, that in 1540 split in six contending Khaganates, all of them more or less based on slave trading and slave raiding. Indeed, right up to the 17th century, Russia in general, and Ukraine in particular, and not yet Africa, was likely the world's main supplier of slaves. The peasant there, therefore, lived in constant danger of being enslaved, and that seems to have virtually emptied the Ukraine by the late 15th century. Russia only surpassed France as Europe's largest population in 1800. And that indeed still explains a lot about Napoleon. Napoleon could afford to callously squander lives, as he had, after all, Europe's largest population, and he could draw on that. And Russia could do precisely the same later on. Throughout the 19th and the 20th century, right up to the 1960s, if one bunch of raw Russian recruits were killed, there were always more available where they came from. The figures on Africa, I informed guesses, as there was obviously no centralized political authority in Africa that could have gathered information on the population. By the most cautious estimate, there were 3,000 political units in Africa in 1500, and that is very likely still on the low side. All population figures on Africa are therefore more or less extrapolations from the 19th century, and they are therefore far too low, since it is reasonable that, as in Russia, the slave trade may have caused a drop in population. Though in West Africa, this may not have caused as much demographic disruption as one might have expected. Because basically, what matters for reproduction of a population is not the number of men missing in a population, but the number of women of childbearing age missing in a population. Men, after all, can have children with several women. And in Africa, polygamy was the norm. They indeed did. The slave trade was heavily biased towards men. Some 70% of all slaves were men. And about the worst possible slave to fetch across the Atlantic was a woman with a child, as a woman with a child obviously, cannot work full-time. She has to care for the child, after all. In other words, however morally bad that entire trade may have been, it may not have had that much of an impact on the population of West Africa. Coming to the figure, by the most cautious estimate, Morocco had 1.5 million inhabitants. West Africa, remember, a very large area, about the same size as Europe, may have had 50 million inhabitants, as said, with the densest cluster in Yoruba countries, where there may have lived about 4 million people. Ethiopia likely had 10 million people. Angola and the Congo together, because they were in the 15th century more or less the same area, may have had 4 million. The Great Lake region may have had 2 million. East Africa, we know very little about it, may have had 4 million. Perhaps 1 million in Buganda. Madagascar had about 1 million, and Southern Africa may have had about 2 million, because that area had a very thin, mostly decadal population. The figures on Madagascar and on the Congo are extrapolations from the 19th century. And to my impression, the population of Madagascar increased from the 16th into the 19th century, while that of Congo, for this was an area which was severely hit by the slave trade, was dropping from the 15th into the 20th century. Of all the figures we have been considering so far, those for the Americas are the most difficult and the most disputed. Indeed, producing figures on pre-Columbian population of the Americas has become virtually an industry. For two reasons. First of all, if virtually nobody lived on the land later on settled by white Anglo-Saxon colonists, the Native Americans had a very weak claim on it. And therefore, the tendency throughout the 19th and early 20th century was to claim North America, before the whites came there, was empty, except for roaming bunches of savages. And second, if the Americas were densely settled before the coming of the Spaniards, this has major consequences for the way we view the whole world history. For the history of the Americas is commonly relegated to a mere footnote in the history of civilization. Now, it used to be thought, up to the 1950s, that the Americas supported a very low population, estimated at perhaps 10 million for the entire continent, and at best. Then two Berkeley demographers, Sherburne Cook and Woodrow Bora, began on the basis of careful and cautious research on early Spanish tax and population returns to dramatically revise the figures of the population of Mexico in an upward direction. Though Sherburne and Bora are generally recognized to have done the most thorough research, they have been hotly contested all the same, because they show an almost impossible drop of population in the 16th century. And furthermore, it is argued, the massive population densities reported by Cook and Bora could never have been achieved by a stone and obsidian civilization. A civilization that was technologically no more advanced than Europe was in 10,000 before Common Era, and the whole European continent in that period is considered to have supported less than 3 million people. Many scholars tend therefore to stick to a much lower figure than that of Cook and Bora. It seems to me, however, that as Bora's figure of 50 million would give Mexico about the same population as France in the same period, Borras' figure is not that unrealistic. For if the pre-Columbian Mexicans, to be sure, cultivated their land with very basic tools, maize also has a far higher yield than grain. 7 against 25. And as it is cultivated by a hoe, it does not need any plowing. So that the non-availability of iron would be not that much of an impediment. Given that high productivity of Mexican agriculture, Mexico is likely to have supported a very large population. And Mexico is after all much larger than France. The same of course applies to the potato, on which the agriculture in the Andes is based. And that is another miracle crop, with high yields and a higher nutritional value than grain. Estimates of the population in the Andes are again highly contested, and they are highly politically charged as well. They range between 2 and 18 million. And it is at best to assume a medium, that is about 10 million. Very recent excavations in the Amazons have led to a dramatic upward revision of the population of that region. It may have been about 1 million. It seems therefore reasonable to estimate the population of modern Brazil, whatever the term may mean in the 15th century, at about 4 million. The population of North America is the most hotly contested of all. And it is the most uncertain too. It seems reasonable to assess perhaps at 10 million. Finally, to end this somewhat tiresome enumeration, the population of Australia was probably less than 500,000, whereas, due to the severe epidemics that ravaged the population of Polynesia in the 19th century, population figures there should be dramatically revised upward. The largest island group, Hawaii, may have had about 400,000 inhabitants. New Zealand may have had perhaps 300,000. Perhaps it is reasonable to settle on a total population figure for the Pacific in about 1600 of about 1 million. Which impression does this, to be sure highly tentative, tentative efforts leave us with? First of all, it should serve to impress on us how absolutely critical demography is for history. And demography is closely linked to, and indeed inseparable from, the climate. It's arguable that the Little Ice Age precisely coincided with a period of 5 centuries, in which Europeans had less children than they had had before, and than they had after. And all this may not be a coincidence. For, arguably, the pattern of reproduction, that is, how many children couples have, and how late in life they marry and have children, the critical factor in history, and it still is, as I will argue later on. This would not be so strange a statement to French historians, for whom demography is a second nature. But American historians tend to be oblivious to demography. Now, one of the verities in which American students are always drilled is the Malthusian scissor, named after the economist, though he was actually a parson by training, Thomas Malthus. That means the food supply increases arithmetically, 2, 4, 6, 8, and so forth. While human populations increase geometrically, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. This means that human populations would run out of food eventually, and they would die out in famines. This is throughout supposed to be typical of pre-industrial society. Now, in fact, a whole generation of demographers working on these very same dreary church ledgers have shown precisely the opposite is the case. As human beings, unlike the spore cultures that are so dear to big historians, are rational beings. If your land begins to run out, and it yields ever less, and there is therefore always also lesser land to grant to your children, what human beings will do is that they will limit the number of children they have, whether that is by abortion or by abandoning children, as was, in my impression, common in India, at least up to the 1950s. Or they may marry very late in life. For obviously, a lady married at 17 or at 14, still the common age of marriage in India, until very recently, can have more children than a woman who is married at 24, the average age of marriage in Europe by 1500. Where, we must remember, average life expectancy in Europe was then around 42. With such a late marriage, and given that only 1 in 3 children will reach maturity, a couple in Europe in 1500 could place themselves happy if they had 2 children. That is, just the rate a society would need to demographically reproduce itself. Hence, populations in Europe, from roughly the 13th into the mid-18th century, remained stable. In 1750, Europe had roughly the same population as it had in 1300. That is, just before the Great Famine of 1315 to 1322, that was of course followed by the onslaught of the famed Black Death, 1346 to 1352, and that was followed by constant, repeated outbreaks of the plague later on. And all this was because humans reacted rationally to the threat of Malthusian schism. Now that Europeans married very late in life has had, in my view, an absolutely critical impact on European culture. It basically meant that the large adolescent population, age obviously that you most lust after sex, had to be disciplined into abstaining from sex. And furthermore, to be disciplined in this for generation after generation after generation. In the terms of Sigmund Freud, Europeans had to be instilled with a collective superego by their parents as much as by the authorities, and in this case, this means the church. They had to be instilled with a collective superego that lusting after sex was improper, particularly so at an age that the people were still considered immature. For women, up to 24 or 25. Now, what this caused in Europeans throughout was a particularly difficult and skewed attitude towards sex. European difficulty with sex that has been a feature of European civilization ever since. And that makes the European demographic pattern of late marriage in life so peculiar. It flowed upwards rather than downwards. The common pattern of the adaptation of a custom or need of products is that it is first adopted by the upper class, that means the nobility, and then gradually diffused amongst the peasants. Yet with this demographic pattern, we are dealing with a pattern that was first adopted by the peasants, and that was then adopted, late, and very reluctantly, by the nobility. You may realize, up to at least the 19th century, European royalty practiced a special kind of polygamy, as the king, next to his wife, always had several recognized mistresses, who even would sleep in the bedroom next to the bedroom of his official consort. I have to add two more things to all that. One of them a bit speculative, the other one is very obvious, but it is still a difficult issue. First, historian Richard Higham argued that one of the main motives for British overseas expansion in the 19th century was to make the world to bordello British men, and for British adolescents in particular. These men wanted to seek sexual opportunities denied to them in such a pruder society as Victorian England. This point may well be enlarged to include European society at large. Europeans went abroad in search of sexual opportunities that were denied them under the European demographic system. And second, and here the matter becomes speculative, if you were to make a psychological profile of the average European football hooligan nowadays, the first thing to note is that he is invariably a young adult, only under 20. And second, that he rarely or never has a wife. Indeed, he rarely has a girlfriend, let alone a family. After getting married, your average football hooligan invariably mellows. Now, what the European marriage pattern may have done was to produce a mass of hooligans, who Europe, as it were, then let loose both upon Europe itself and upon the rest of the world. For Europe, with its European demographic pattern, was likely the most violent society of the early modern world. Second, this numerical exercise serves to impress upon us both the absolute numerical and the relative economic preponderance of China in the pre-1492 world. For any period roughly extending beyond the 3rd century Common Era, and indeed right up to the 19th century, China was incontestably the Middle Kingdom. It was the center of the world, as the Chinese saw themselves, and they had good reason for that. Furthermore, and that is a view that has meanwhile even seeped out to the general public, for China did not cease to remind us during such occasions as the opening of the Olympic Games, China was from the 10th to roughly the 15th century also technologically far ahead of the rest of the world. Much as during the 19th century, you had the best chance of getting industrialized, the closer you were in location and the closer you were in culture to England, so too during this period, your chances of picking up advanced technologies improved the closer you were in location to China. But a lot surely depends too on your willingness to study and learn from China. Iran, and Khwarizm in particular, thus served as a conduit for transmitting advanced Chinese technology. Because particularly during the Mongol period, in the 13th century, Iranian intellectuals assiduously studied Chinese secrets, whether it be the compass and gunpowder, that appears to have come to Europe via the Khaganates in Central Asia, somewhere early in the 13th century. Again, paper, or the other critical invention, printing. With all these obvious technological innovations that Europe clearly derived from China, some 5 or even 9 centuries after the technology had been invented there, the problem is to ascertain whether the Europeans copied the actual technology or more or less only heard of it. They picked up the idea it could be done, and then they reinvented the technology for themselves. With gunpowder, it appears as if the Europeans imported the technology from China. Yet for printing, it appears as if the Europeans heard of the idea and then reinvented the technology themselves. In which case, Hans Gutenberg may still legitimately be called the inventor of printing in Europe. Third, despite this Chinese preponderance, we may say that the world was since 1492 in some ways more balanced than it was to be again until the 1950s of the past century. Africa's population was nearly the same as Europe's. Asia was 3 times larger, the Americas were about half. Arguably, since 1492, the world has ever more tilted out of balance, the main factor of which has been the steady increase in the number of Europeans to the detriment of the populations of the New World. Those populations were utterly decimated from now 1492 onwards, and the Europeans then moved in. It was not to be the last of these democratic catastrophes that served to increasingly enhance Europe's role in the world. Yet this demographic collapse in the Americas was likely unprecedented in the whole of human history, unless we want to go all the way back to the explosion of the Toba volcano in 77,000 before Common Era, which may have similarly reduced human populations to a tenth of what they had been previously. We shall deal with this issue in the next lecture.